You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to Beyond Hair Loss, SmartCast Conversations in Alopecia Care, Microlearning Podcast Series. I am your host, Lisa Koons, and today we are discussing how we assess disease severity in alopecia areata, or AA. While tools like the SALT score remain foundational, clinicians often find that severity in real-world practice is far more nuanced. Factors like facial hair involvement, psychosocial burden, and disease progression can significantly influence treatment decisions, sometimes more than the numeric score itself. Today, we'll explore where traditional tools fall short and how a more dynamic, patient-centered approach can improve care. I'm joined by Dr. Aaron Farber, a board-certified dermatologist and owner at Bayer Dermatology in Dallas, Texas. Thank you so much for being here today.
Hi, Lisa. Thank you so much for having me. Excited to talk about one of my favorite topics, alopecia areata.
Awesome. So let's jump right in. So when assessing disease severity in AA, what are the biggest gaps in traditional approaches?
Well, you know, the biggest gaps for our traditional assessments, you know, you think about the traditional tools such as the severity of alopecia tool, the SALT tool, the SALT scores, they're heavily weighted towards simply a percentage of the scalp that has hair loss. Now, you know, while that's, you know, very straightforward, it provides, you know, much easier standardization. It's an objective measure. The problem is it misses several clinically meaningful dimensions. So, for example, and you mentioned this earlier, it does not account for eyebrow or eyelash or beard or other body hair loss, which obviously can carry a disproportionate amount of burden, think particularly even, you know, psychosocial burden. It also ignores disease severity, the chronicity, as well as whether or not it's been responsive to other treatments. You know, perhaps, you know, most importantly, the SALT score doesn't actually capture any patient-reported impact. And, you know, that's what we're all taught in medical school is, you know, to really empathize and understand, you know, what and how the patient is feeling. So, you know, how distressing or functionally even limiting, you know, this disease really is. And let's be real, most of that actually drives most of our treatment decisions more than just body surface area alone. So that isn't easily recorded or reported in our SALT scores.
So kind of building upon that, could you share a clinical scenario where the SALT score would kind of underestimate the severity and impacts management?
Well, yeah, you know, consider a young professional, you know, like myself. Got patchy scalp involvement, and so a SALT score of, you know, 15%, you know, but they have a complete loss of all of their eyebrows and eyelashes, or even just partial, right? So from a SALT standpoint, or the SALT score, you know, this could be classified as mild to moderate disease, but obviously the absence of eyelashes really increases all sorts of issues, including ocular irritation. You know, the eyebrow loss, you know, leads to, it's really a primary aspect of people's facial identity. So in practice, you know, this would justify, in my opinion, escalation immediately to systemic therapy. This is obviously a huge burden having a big impact on this patient, despite what, you know, the low SALT score alone might suggest. So relying strictly on SALT scores can lead or risk us undertreating a lot of these patients.
So how does the AA scale kind of improve upon the SALT tool, and particularly in capturing non-scalp hair loss and quality of life?
Yeah, so the AA scale, the alopecia areata scale, expands beyond scalp surface area, not just that percentage of surface area, but includes non-scalp hair loss, as well as patient-reported outcomes. It actually integrates other domains such as the eyebrow and eyelash involvement, which, you know, we just learned from our little vignette, you know, why important that is. Also includes things like nail disease. And, you know, I would say one of the more important aspects is quality of life. So, you know, it's a multidimensional approach. Again, what we're taught in medical school, and this can better reflect the actual disease burden. When you incorporate, you know, a patient's experience, what sort of emotional distress they're having, what impairment they've had socially, are there any other functional limitation? It really aligns the severity that we classify this disease much more closely or much more aligned with the actual real world impact of this disease. And then of course, that's going to align with our actual therapy, clinical therapy choices.
So you've touched on it a little bit, but could you expand on how should clinicians incorporate quality of life considerations into severity assessment?
Well, I would hope, and I think most all clinicians are including, these quality of life assessments. It may not be as formal, but at least you're asking how the patient is doing, not just with their disease, but the psychosocial aspects around it. But I would say that clinicians should really routinely include some sort of validated patient-reported outcome, these PROs, which are becoming more and more popular and I think easier. You could even, do some, dermatology quality of life instruments alongside with these clinical scorings. And, I think a lot of people are including them just for insurance reasons, but that's fine. At least we're also getting the information from the patient. Even a brief, structured question, are you avoiding social events because of this? Is this impacting your work? Is this causing you emotional distress? Simple questions just like that. You get a couple of those in, doesn't have to be an extended evaluation. My point here is that quality of life shouldn't just be an afterthought. It should probably be one of the first questions because they end up actively influencing our treatment decisions by adjusting the threshold. And we all know this as clinicians, this is where the art of medicine comes in, weighing that risk benefit. Once you understand how impactful a disease can be, it's going to change that threshold for a therapy selection. You could imagine, in some cases where there's a very high psychosocial burden, but maybe a small SALT score or a small area that represents hair loss, that would still justify, a systemic therapy because of the burden that this patient is undergoing.
So what differentiates the alopecia areata severity and morbidity index from the existing tools?
So the alopecia areata severity and morbidity index, it attempts to unify multiple dimensions: the extent of hair loss, scalp or even non-scalp, the disease activity, the chronicity, as well as the patient reported outcomes or morbidity. So its key advantage really is that it frames alopecia areata as both the physical, the clinical disease, as well as the psychosocial disease, which I think we all see this disease truly as. So you're combining these clinician reported outcomes along or the objective clinician reported measures with the patient reported elements to create a composition score. And this obviously leads to just a more holistic, clinically actionable, as we're talking about, assessment, when you can really understand what's going on from the clinician side as well as the patient side and put it all into one sort of single, tool domain. That's like the holy grail. It's the one-stop shop. We can do everything with that.
So how do chronicity and relapse history sort of shape your assessment of severity and long-term management?
Well, as a clinician, I know we always ask for, history, and we want to know what's been going on. And we do that because we're basically asking this question: what is How has this disease been going for you? What's been the progression? So I would say, you know, the chronicity, as you asked, and whether or not this is relapsing or if there's any sort of pattern, it's absolutely critical. It's literally the first part of what we do as any clinician that we learn in medical school. So, you know, a patient with longstanding disease or treatment refractory disease, even if it's limited, you know, again, we're saying smaller, you know, percent body surface area that's affected, even if it's limited, if it's been longstanding and it hasn't responded to any sort of treatments, well, you know, that patient's going to have a very different prognosis and obviously going to have very different management selections, management pathways than somebody who's just walked in with a first acute episode, you know, even for a larger, you know, surface area. So if you have a patient with frequent relapses, it can suggest some sort of, you know, more dysregulation, I would say, in the immune system that would obviously warrant, you know, intervention on a systemic level, perhaps earlier intervention. We're learning more and more about these inflammatory diseases and realizing if we can get to, you know, the disease early enough, sometimes we can have some sort of actual long-term modification. You know, these factors are also, I think, important because it helps us manage patients' expectations. And, you know, on a personal level, I would say as clinicians, as physicians, that's really our entire job, is we manage patients' expectations. And so if we have a good history and we understand somebody with longstanding or treatment refractory disease, it really helps us manage that patient's expectations. We set those expectations for the patient and help guide them through a longer term plan, recognizing this is going to impact what sort of treatments we choose now and for a longer period, you know, such as maintenance therapies.
How important is incorporating prior treatment history into the severity assessment?
I think it's incredibly important. Kind of as I was just saying, it really does start with, you know, a history. At least our medical assistants can go in and get the history and understand what they've done. But then I wouldn't doubt it if every clinician, when they walk in, say, well, okay, what have you tried for this before? So prior treatment response is probably one of the most practical severity indicators. We know if somebody has failed first line therapy that this disease is going to be a little bit more difficult to treat. So, I mean, if somebody's already failed intralesional steroids, we know that this is a more resistant biology pathology that's going on with this AA. So, you know, escalating our decisions can often be based off of objective outcomes, but, you know, whether or not the disease is progressing or whether or not it's resistant can also impact our management selections. So, you know, documenting what has been tried, how the disease has responded. I mean, this is like, you know, standard bread and butter, should be done and is incredibly important in understanding the next sequence or the next therapy selection for the patient.
So to wrap up, we have a few minutes left. So if you could redesign severity assessment for AA just from scratch, what would it include that current tools are missing?
Ooh, I feel like a kid in a candy store. This is great. So I get to do my own severity assessment design from scratch. I guess there'd be a better pun instead of scratch. I'd scratch my head, but then I'd get some alopecia areata. So the ideal system, as we discussed, we want it to be multidimensional and we want it to be dynamic. And most importantly, we want it to be patient-centric. You know, let's not forget that empathy. So of course, objective outcomes, the extent of the hair loss. And we want it to be scalp and non-scalp. And I think that's, you know, a very easy objective outcome to include. We also want to know the disease activity. You know, are we shedding? Are there, you know, is there progression of the disease? We want to know about the chronicity or whether or not it's relapsing. you brought that up, and I totally agree. That's super important. And then we want the history. So has it been responsive to any treatment in the past? And also sometimes there can be various risk modifiers, such as the nail involvement that we discussed about earlier. And then finally, the cherry on top. But you know, maybe this is actually the ice cream at the bottom too, is the patient-reported outcomes. At the end of the day, our goal is to make the patient happy so that it's not impacting their life. I don't want this disease to have any impact whatsoever on their life. So if we can include some sort of patient-reported outcomes that include the whole gamut of the psychosocial, emotional, is it having any impact on you functionally? If we could include the PROs in this, I think this would create a very nice composite score that could help tell us whether or not we're having an impact on this disease. But you know, I'd always, you know, as a clinical trialist, I would say it's also nice to have sometimes these things separated out so we can really see the impact across all these different modalities when we select the therapy for our patients. So it's a fun thought process. I mean, let's get like 10 more dermatologists in a room and put our brains together and see if we can make something even better. But that was fun.
Well, Dr. Farberg, thank you so much for sharing your insights. That's all we have time for today. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. We hope you will listen to another episode from this series. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would also like to give a special thank you to our supporter, Lily, who provided an educational grant for this activity.